Good morning, good evening, good afternoon from wherever you are. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group and proud host of Voices for Excellence. And today's guest is a friend that I just admire specifically with her work that she has done nationally around policy development and policy structures, but the focus has been with students with disabilities, and her voice carries weight. And I love to, you know, I'm serving with her as a senior fellow for Getting Smart, and some of her white papers, her blogs, you know, her papers that she has generated over the course of her education tenure has really moved the needle. And when we talk about someone that has a voice at the table and commands your attention, today's guest is certainly that individual. And I would like to welcome Carla Phillips Krivikas from Arizona. Carla, how are you today?
I'm good, but like we were just talking, I'm a little warm.
We're a little warm now. In full transparency for everybody, where I'm at, Rochester, New York, today, yes, I can wear a turtleneck. It is 44 degrees. Carla is in Arizona. And just for the episode, she put on, you know, she put on the suit coat where it is 100 degrees. So I asked her before we started recording, Carla, do you got your AC on? Because, sister, I know you hot out there in that Arizona heat right now. But thank you for that. I mean, Carla, I have been, you know, a huge admirer of your work, specifically your advocacy work for students with disabilities, accountability, which we will go into in depth in with this episode, but also on the vitality that you're bringing to state boards across the country, more over of where you serve, your current role that you serve on the Arizona State Board of Education. But you're also the CEO of Think Inclusion. We're CEO and founder of that. So, Carla, we're going to get into all that, but just thank you for being a guest on BFB. But my first question, right? This is a fun question, and I can't wait for you to answer this because, you know, I got to hear what Carla is talking about, right? Now, full disclosure, Carla's son is on his way to hopefully be signing a Division I basketball scholarship. So within the next few weeks. So that's why, you know, Carla, she got, look, I need tickets. Wherever he goes, I need tickets because I'm going to be a fan. But I just want to put that out there. But when politicians who develop education policy, educators that contact you from the State Board of Education, your current role in Arizona, and even special education advocates across the country, when they encounter Carla Phillips Krivikas for the first time, what song describes your vitality for inclusionary practices in education? What song describes you, Carla? I can't wait to hear this.
Wow. Well, I'm going to divert that for a second while I think about it. And just let you know that my last name is Krivikas, just on behalf of my, I'm newly married. So on behalf of him, I'll make sure it's Krivikas.
Listen, I've been chopping up last names, Carla. So I'm glad. Say it one more time, Carla.
Krivikas.
I got it. I will make the mistake again, sister.
Man, I am trying so hard to type work to a J-Lo song right now. I'm literally going through my workout playlist. I wish I could type to something J-Lo or Janet have said over the years. But yeah, the song that really comes to mind is actually, it's a song by Nicole Nordeman, and it's called Legacy. And in the song, she says, I want to leave a legacy. How will they remember me? Did I choose to love? Did I leave a mark on things? I want to leave an offering. And that's what I hope people encounter, is that they know that I'm not in it for the money. I'm not even just a mom. I'm doing it to make a difference. I want to leave a legacy. When I think about civil rights movements, right? It's always been generation passing the baton to the next generation. And there have been a couple leaders that I've had the privilege of working with, you know, years ago that I feel have passed the baton to me. Yeah. So Legacy, Nicole Nordeman is the song I hope they think of when they see me.
Absolutely. And the work that you're doing is legacy work. Your advocacy, you know, at the state and national level, is legacy work, and you're going to continue to leave your legacy, specifically what you're doing, you know, with Think Inclusion and that work, right? You have done some tremendous work nationally in the context of policy development and advocacy support with Grounded Excellence for Students with Disabilities. Now, for my listeners who are not familiar with Think Inclusion, you are the CEO and founder. What is it, right? What is the organization's mission? What are your goals and objectives? And if you live outside, or one of my listeners live outside of Arizona, how would they be able to join this coalition?
Thank you. My mission is to make sure that students with disabilities are included in every policy, program, and initiative, mm-hmm. public and not and non-public, like in terms of foundations, philanthropic work. So often we use the term equity, but students with disabilities are not included. That's right. My mission. I saw a gap. So I have about almost 25 years of public policy experience at the state level, a little bit at the federal level. And then along that journey, I had the privilege of working in the governor's office, the legislature, our Department of Ed. Along that journey, I gave birth to two beautiful kids who also have disabilities. And I started seeing all the work I'd been doing through a different lens. Because, you know, when in education, we like to say, oh, all students, but we're just not always including all. And that was what I was convicted of, is really what would it mean to make sure that all meant all? And the other thing I noticed was that there really was no voice in state capitals. Lots of people in D.C., as you know, mm-hmm. and a lot of people at the state level that are ready and willing to work with families to help them get the services they need, to help them negotiate school relations, IEPs. But nobody was talking about policy and systemic change. And I felt like the system that we've built, and it's all very needed. We need to support families, don't get me wrong. But I kind of started feeling like it was like a system of whack-a-mole. Like, okay, we help that family, another one pops up. We help that family, another one, because we're not fixing the system. Right. And so that's what compelled me to start Think Inclusion. And my website is thinkinclusion.org. Please come there. Think_inclusion is my Twitter handle, where I like to try to promote what that really means.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, the work that you're, or the vitality that you're bringing, years of experience. And I mean, simply correct when we state all, because when we talk about all, I like to say the cause and effect is that we have to redesign and reimagine systems and structures holistically in order to reach all, albeit we still underpin status quo processes and functions that we're not meeting all, you know. And when we talk about student subgroups, specifically students with disabilities, historically, we have seen that where those students are left behind and not included in the conversation of all. Now, this is kind of a subvariant question when we think about this, because when we look at it from an excellence and equity lens, what needs to change? You said fix the system, right? You were playing whack-a-mole, 100% correct, right? I concur with you. You know, we're addressing issues in this siloed, a pocket, not addressing pockets as opposed to holistic in totality. Fixing the system, that resonates with me, Carla. What does that mean in the context of public policy?
So what I've learned in this first year is it's really going to have to start with the re-education. I shouldn't say re-education, education. Yeah. Because what I was vividly reminded of this past year was the vast majority of people in general know very little, if anything, about special education, unless they've been personally touched by it. And what's also been surprising me is how many people, even within education, don't know a lot about special education.
Right.
And there are a lot of myths. And probably the one that has stood out to me the most is that, and I say this tongue in cheek, but most people, when they think of images of special education, the images of autism, Down syndrome, hearing impaired, visually impaired, wheelchairs, those are the visuals that come. And we all reinforce that sometimes, even with the clip art pictures and the things that we use in our reports, right? We reinforce those images. But what's shocking to me, or not to me, but to tell others, is that that represents less than 15% of special ed. Right. 85% of the kids in special or receiving special education services have no cognitive disability whatsoever. Meaning that 85% of them, if getting the services and supports they need, should be reading by third grade, should be graduating on time, should college and career should be a done deal. But we think of that 15% rather than the 85% of invisible disabilities like dyslexia, like ADD, ADHD. And the problem with that myth, Michael, is that if that's in your head, and not everybody wants to admit this, I've had some close friends confide in me that that is true, but if that is your image, there's two problems with that. One is you think special education is super expensive and it's super hard and complicated. So when you're talking about policy, if that's your image, you're not thinking, the example, the issue I'm working a lot on right now is dual enrollment and early college opportunities.
Yeah.
When they think about special ed, if they're thinking of that 15% only, they're not thinking about the student who only needs 1 hour of speech therapy, who of course should be taking a dual enrollment course or any early college opportunity. They're thinking of the really complex learner and how expensive. Those are the talking points that come regardless of what issue I bring. Oh my, you know, special ed's so underfunded. It's so expensive. And I'm not disputing that, but there's 85% of the kids where it's not really, that's not really the case. But that's lowered expectations.
Yeah. And
there's been a lot of myth busting in this work.
Carla, and I just want to interject, wow. And I think that is a compelling metric. I mean, something that I learned, right, around the 15 distinctively with the 85%, right? And the lowering of the expectations, unbelievable. I just had to interject because I think that is such a profound metric that even though there's a concentration on the 15%, we're still leaving out 85%. So we're not truly meeting the demands of all. Am I correct?
Correct. So if you think about, I was looking at a different state's data recently, and only 8% of the students with disabilities in this particular state are reading on grade level.
Wow.
8%. Knowing that only 15% have any cognitive impairment whatsoever. That's a crisis in my mind.
Absolutely, Carla. Absolutely. And
in fact, there was a recent Supreme Court case that was decided unanimously in favor of the family. I won't go into the legal details. At the end of the day, it basically allows families moving forward to have some new legal options. But what stood out to me in the story, you know, just the story you get like on Twitter or whatever Instagram feed you get, was it was about a young man who was hearing impaired. And he's now in his 20s. He's since graduated because you know how long these cases take to go through. And he had basically never gotten the sign language or he never got anything he was supposed to have gotten. His parents didn't find out until he's in 12th grade. And they said, yeah, he's not graduating. He's not going to get a diploma. He'll get a certificate. And the parents were like, holy cow. Now, this student, this article specifically said he had no other disability outside of a hearing disability, okay? He never learned to read. That is a crime.
Yes.
That is a crime.
Yes.
But right now, it's bad enough that we don't look at special education data per se. That bucket holds 13 different categories under federal law. There's a big difference between a kid with dyslexia and a kid who has Down syndrome. Shouldn't affect our expectations, right, for the record.
Absolutely.
But that there's a lot of nuance there. So one of the things I've been pushing heavily is that we all start disaggregating all state-level data by the 13 disability categories. The Arizona Board of Regents was the first to do it for me. I give them a huge shout-out. They reported post-secondary attainment outcomes last year, not only for special education in the subgroup, but broke it out by the 13 disability categories. And wow, was it eye-opening. And I'm sharing that with other states. You know what's so funny? I didn't know we could do that. Yeah, you can. No one's ever asked.
Unbelievable. And Carla, thank you because, that level of the segregated data by the specific categories, 13 different categories, I can infer the conversations and discussions that were elicited by just disaggregating the data and concatenating those categories around broad implications of how the service delivery model for students with disabilities, including, I love it, the invisible disabilities with the 85%. I learned a lot from you every time I talk to you, Carla. But here's the thing. I want you, and I mean, you're spot on with every single sentiment that you're bringing, you're raising. But I want my viewers to unwrap your IP, your intellectual property, in the context of students with disabilities. You're a czar. That's what I mean. I want them to get into your brain. Define for my listeners, define inclusive practices and systems for students with disabilities in the AC stage of education, after COVID stage of education. And then I'll get into the second part of it. But I just want them, in an isolated context, to hear what your definition is regarding inclusive practices and systems for students with disabilities.
Let me unpack that. Inclusive practices at the school level, I'm not necessarily the expert, but I will tell you something that most people don't know outside of special education. It's actually something we have to report. Every state has to report to the federal government the percentage of time that a student with a disability is spending in the general education classroom. Mm-hmm. And each state is supposed to have goals.
Right.
That's a big deal. Most people at the state level don't even know that that data exists or that anybody's even looking at it. And there are lots of different ways that you can define inclusion and support it. I'm not a teacher. I'm all a policy person by nature. But I will tell you that there's a wider scope of that. Inclusive practices is not just how much time they spend in a general education class with their peers. It's also, what does lunch look like?
Yeah.
What do our child activities look like? You know, what does the whole school experience look like? And that's me putting my mom hat on,
frankly. Yeah.
My daughter has been blessed to be in a school where she's in the school play. She was on the cheerleading team. They include her in the entire school experience. I'm not just measuring it by the percent of time she spends in a certain classroom, which is a federal metric, but that's important. My unique niche is to make sure that we're not forgetting about them in policy.
Absolutely.
And it just happens all the time. I can't even describe it. It just happens all the time. And it's that equity lens part that really probably bothers me the most. Because when I think of terms like historically marginalized, historically disadvantaged, outside of Native American students, I can't think of a group that's been more historically disadvantaged or marginalized than students with disabilities.
Right.
My students are African American, and I always joke that, you know, my son had the right to go to public school in what, 1952, or Brown, right? 52?
54.
My daughter didn't have that right till 1974.
Wow. So huge. So can you elaborate for my listeners why the big discrepancy with 1954 Brown v. Board of Education versus 1974? Most of my readers, listeners, including myself, not familiar with the act you're talking about, 1974. Can you just provide a brief high level abstraction of what that is?
There were a series of Supreme Court cases that ultimately led to the passage of the federal law that we now call IDEA, which is spawned special education. They were not required to take students that had what we would have called back then mental retardation.
Right.
And now they are. So as I'm saying, she would not have been guaranteed to attend school. And I'm going to tell you something that I wasn't even thinking about this when we jumped on the call, but I was doing a training class this weekend on developmental disabilities. You know, in my little world and some of the moms and friends I have, we really still lament the state of the state and complain about things. But I had a really big gut check this weekend. So in this training class, they were talking about the history of developmental disabilities. They told me something I had never heard before. Did you know that Geraldo Rivera, back in the early 70s, did an expose on institutions for kids with developmental disabilities?
And I know that.
And it's really apparently what launched his career. I never knew this either. Apparently, he was at dinner with a friend in New York in the 70s. And the friend was, and I apologize for anybody listening out there if I get this wrong. I just heard it Saturday. But his friend was a doctor at Willowbrook, which at that time was the biggest institution in the country. It was built for 4,000 students, had over 6,000.
Wow.
And he told his friend, Geraldo, that he couldn't do it anymore. He couldn't stand. He was witnessing such bad abuse and awful conditions. He couldn't do it anymore. So Ronaldo said, well, what can I do? And I think it was like the guy like stole a key or something. So Ronaldo got to go in. And he wrote, I honestly couldn't even watch it. I pulled it up. I could, because the pictures just made me sick of what he saw. And so it was a big gut check. I'm sorry, I'm getting emotional. The gut check for me right now is, as much as I can lament the status quo right now, when I think about what would have happened had my daughter been born 40, 50 years ago, it's striking. But people forget. Then, you know, people forget history. People forget history.
Absolutely.
The woman who met me in the hospital when my daughter was born told me that when her son was born, and I'm guessing in his 30s now, that the nurse told her, just tell your family that he passed away today and we'll take him. And they were going to put him in an institution. That was just 3 decades ago here. So sorry about that emotional little rant, but I have to give myself that gut check too and think about passing the baton and leaving that legacy. I think about the people who fought for that right and what I'm trying to fight for now and grateful for what they did.
And I want to, Carla, underpin what you're fighting for now, right? And when I look at you, you're building the next set of shoulders for the leaders that are going to continue your work and strengthen it, your work as well, years beyond. You and I are here, which I hope it continues. But you wrote this compelling report for the state of Colorado, right? And it was entitled, How to Illuminate Pathways for Students with Disabilities. I saw that in Colorado. Very, very stark report, right? I look at this as that recommendations and the implementation process with that, and some of the core facts identified in that report was on target. But it cannot just only be applied in Colorado, but universally, right? Like, I'm thinking like how this can impact students with disabilities on a very, very, very broad sense. I'm like, wow, okay. This is not just limited here, but can be applied here, can be applied there. State policy or public policy at the state level, you know, anywhere across the country. But from the report right now, right, just kind of want to just isolate it so that leaders that are on here, whether at the state level or even at the local governance level, they have that report. What strategies can be replicated or can be cogitated on strategically so that it can universally improve the service delivery model of special education in their respective state or district?
Well, thank you for that question. That report or that issue of dual enrollment or concurrent enrollment in Colorado is a perfect example of state policy work in education. The issues are usually always the same by state. The solutions may be different, right? Given the unique policy or political context of a state, even their statutory construction, but the issues are the same. So I did, that Colorado report came before the Rhode Island report I just did a few weeks ago, similar, and a national report I did. And here are the 3 big issues I found generally. One, data. 9 times out of 10, the states weren't even looking at students with disabilities as a subgroup when it came to, and I'm using dual, concurrent, all those terms kind of synonymously right now, early college opportunities. They weren't even looking at students with disabilities. Yeah. In fact, Arizona just released its first report. And they included students with disabilities. And guess what we found? On average, in Arizona, 24.5% of students are taking dual enrollment courses. The number of students with disabilities was so low, it couldn't even be reported.
Wow.
Meaning it was less than 2%.
Yeah.
So, yeah, data. Data, right? That's the same of all states. I beg them all to look at their data and start looking at new data. 2 is... under the federal law, students with disabilities have something called an IEP, an individual education program. When they turn 16, it's supposed to contain a transition plan to post-secondary goals. That is an underutilized tool for AP, CTE, dual enrollment, all of these things. Those things should be baked into a student's IEP. So one of my other recommendations is for state departments of education to develop some guidance, some manuals to really help the school level people figure out how to bake that into a student's IEP so they don't miss out on those opportunities. 3rd is the biggest one. It's a legal one. What I heard all across the country, I talked to a lot of states, was that the colleges were telling high schools that because it's a college course, they don't have to honor IEPs. Well, the problem is depending on how your state defined it, but I'll use Arizona as an example. Arizona defines dual enrollment as a high school course on a high school campus, getting high school credit that they can also get college credit. So me and some attorneys I've been meeting with, like, you cannot tell a high school kid getting high school credit that they have to let their federal entitlement go at, or what we call FAPE, a free and appropriate education. Their IEP has to be honored. I found only three states that had said that, and that was Washington, Oregon, and Minnesota, Oregon, and Illinois. And hopefully with a little bit of luck, Arizona will be the fourth state.
I know you're pushing that, Carla. I know you're pushing that.
Lucky, but it's a one-sentence amendment that says IEPs and 504 plans have to be honored. Now, I've made it very clear to the advocates that if a student requires significant modifications to content and outcomes, then the college can decide not to award college credit, and that's fair.
Right.
But that was an example of an issue that I saw. I have every single state mentioned it in some way, shape, or form. But the answer is pretty much the same. It's federal law. But it's been practiced for so long. And we can see from the national data, let alone state data, that it's not coming up. And I would argue that it's a cart before the horse. That message has sent a really dampening effect. If you're a high school staffer or a special education teacher and the college is telling you sorry, then you're probably not even going to think about introducing these ideas to your students.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up, Carla, because again, I think that this is, it's not a continuous practice that we see in education, is looking at data and examining, unwrapping data in a variety of different ways, right? And I think that is really important that we go, there's a depth and breadth and a scope and scale of how we're using the data, but I think it's the right data that needs to be collected and analyzed. And you're so correct around the IEP and the transition for rigor. I haven't heard that, you know, that language and baked into that. Very, very important. I hope that your work, Carla, will be able to stretch across the country. Obviously, your impact has been concretized in Arizona. You have examined, you are a deep researcher with data. That's what I admire about you, right? I know that if I'm going to come with you or come break something up with you, I know I got to have the empirical evidence, as well as what are the quantitative associations and correlations with that. That's why the advocacy work that you're doing, I'm seeing it in Arizona, your impact. I'm sure that we're going to see that nationally. But let's talk about the national work. And this is just the work that we're doing together that I get to learn from you, Carla. I'm telling you, every time I talk to you, even right now, this podcast recording, I am learning so much with regards to students with disabilities and the policy aspect of it. But, you know, we have the honor to serve as senior fellows together for Getting Smart. But for you, pertaining to you as a senior fellow for Getting Smart, how has that work and the organization strengthened the coalition work we need to support all students, right? You have been doing a lot of blog work with regards to a lot of blog and generating a lot of different type of, whether it be excerpts or even advocacy work through Getting Smart. So, but my question is, what have you learned is one of the biggest problems of practice as it pertains to advancing this work of all? And I want to include my new critical learning, the 15% and the 85%, that 100%, right? How do we advance the work for all, in order not to lose the next two generations of students that we're seeing right now in the AC stage of education, Generation Z and Generation Alpha?
So I've been blessed to be working with Getting Smart on and off for many years. They've been advocating for innovation, competency-based learning, personalized learning long before COVID. But yeah, you know, we've all probably talked about this too much, but we all know that COVID shed a light an education we've never seen. It's brought about a shift. Yeah. And the parents got a bird's eye view of their child's education like they had never had before. And the students got to experience new and different ways to learn. And it generated even more discontent with the one-size-fits-all model. And I think that's the connection between the great and fun work we're doing getting smart and the work that I'm doing. I've long been saying that personalized learning is special education done well, done right for all kids. I have to share something really fun with you. I'm actually writing a paper on this for KnowledgeWorks on how personalized learning and special education work together. And I interviewed a gentleman from Utah, and I'm going to read a quote that he gave that I thought was so good. He said, "The advent of special education was a recognition that not all students fit in the traditional one-size-fits-all model. Personalized learning is an admission that really no one does."
Right.
And I just love that because he's absolutely right. 40, 50 years ago, we said, well, maybe there's some kids that need some extra help, accommodations, modifications. And now, post-COVID or AC, we're going, why are we trying to send everybody into this model? And I love that. It's a time that's come. It's a time that's come. We shouldn't be questioning, well, why does only one kid need extra time? Why does only one kid need triangle crayons? Why does only one? Why doesn't everybody get these things? We really want to engage learners in a way that is new and profound.
Absolutely. And Carla, I love your definition where, yes, personalized learning, that precision around personalized instruction, you're right, is really individualized at its best and monitored and changed at this copious level of intent. And I see that, you know, every student should be on an IEP if we're going to reach that level of personalization with all of our students. But, you know, I want to ask a subvariant question because, you know, we have IEP, right? And IEPs, federal policy with the implementation of IEPs, and we have to meet specific mandated hours with our students with disabilities. But why do we see ad hoc implementation across the country? I mean, you just made a simple, going back to the last question that was asked in your answer is IEPs in the context of there should be a transition where this tool is being underutilized for rigor and access. But how do we even get to a level of just implementing IEPs with a level of integrity and fidelity at the site-based level?
Oh, Michael, if I could answer that question, I'd be queen. Queen of the world. That is such a heavy question. It would take so much time. Let me share this with you, though. First of all, I want to go back on something I already said. I'll come back to what you just said. The word individualized scares people, and even personalized. Yeah. And I've seen that over and over in the years, and even in the interviews I've done for this recent project, because what a teacher envisions 30 student plans, right? 30. But what I'm learning from these people, the people that I've been interviewing recently, is that what it means is that you're giving a level of flexibility and a menu of different ways that different kids can access it. And I think that's a really important thing to think about. So it's not about customizing 30 individual plans. It's about designing an environment that's got built-in flexibility that students know they can access the content and demonstrate their knowledge in different ways.
Right.
So I want to point out those two words make people nervous. One of the things I've been thinking probably all too much about lately is actually a piece I've been wanting to write, and it's called Tear Down the Wall. There's just this wall that has developed over the years between special education and general education. And you can see it at the State Department. You can see it at a district administrative office. You can see it at the school office. You can see it in classrooms. And you can hear it when you hear these terms, and you hear them often if you listen. These kids, those kids.
Yeah.
And one of the things I've been thinking about, and I'm going to throw a big idea out there because I know you like big, crazy ideas. So I'm going to throw one out there. When people enter the College of Education, regardless of the university, by the way, what's one of the first decisions they have to make? Whether they're going to pursue a general education certificate or elementary and secondary, or a special education certificate. So I've been thinking a lot that we're literally putting the foundation for that all on day one, because we're basically asking them to choose which kids they want to specialize in or teach. And then we're shocked when 10 years later they said, oh, I don't teach those kids. I feel like we're really laying that at the very level, and that's where I've been spending a lot of my time thinking about this. How do we unwind that? Because we also know, I shouldn't say we, people who are great teachers, I'm not a great teacher, but great teachers have always told me one thing over the years. Great teaching is great teaching for all kids.
Absolutely.
So if that's the case, why are we such a bifurcated system? If we know the strategies that will work for the kids most at risk, regardless of if they're gifted, have a disability, if they're English language learners, if we know that those strategies will work for everybody, why aren't we just teaching those? I just have to tell you that because that's been on my head a lot lately.
Thank you. No.
Now you know why I don't sleep.
Carla, I could tell you, no, you bring in this vitality and veracity around how we're trying to change the policy structure and the implementation and execution of those historical policy structures that have kept students behind, specifically when we look at students with disabilities, how we can ensure that we're capturing capturing the voices of our students. And what I mean by the voices of our students is that, you know, the student group that has historically been left behind, as I stated, I'm thinking about this not even from an anecdotal standpoint, but quantitative and the antecedents of quote unquote excellence that we're supposed to see within our traditional teaching and learning norms. So I think that you're defining the new normalization through your advocacy and your policy work. So I appreciate that. But I want to underscore that because you have, you know, done previous work at the federal level. You've done your current work at the state level, how you're helping states all across the country. But your current role on the Arizona State Board of Education, right, is bringing this renewed level of rigor and accountability to advance outcomes at this exponential rate for students with disabilities. Now, in this new paradigm of the AC stage of education, because again, I really want people to unwrap your thinking with this, define accountability, right? And you know I'm going to ask this, Carla. I'm right with you, sister. Define accountability. But here's the thing. Sustained accountability. And what does it look like from an implementation standpoint at the policy level or policy perspective down to the SEA? Or the SEA to the LEA, local education agency, and then in the school process within our schools and our buildings.
I have always been a fervent believer of accountability. It is critical for parents. Schools need to be accountable to parents.
Yeah.
So there's got to be a level of transparency there. So one thing that, you know, Getting Smart has been talking about for a long time is that, you know, the traditional letter grade system.
Yeah.
In schools is basically, you know, turning in your homework, sitting in the desk for 880 days, very compliance oriented. It's not really a demonstration of what mastery is or what they really learn. So that, I mean, we know that. We know that parents depend primarily on grades from their teachers to determine how their child is doing, which goes back to that Supreme Court case. That's what the parents said. We're getting good grades. But why, what now you're telling us that? That was an example of that. You know, at the state and the federal level, it's such a complicated question, and unfortunately one that I've been involved in for a long time in a lot of different roles. But I'll say this. I do believe there's got to be a new generation of accountability. It's going to take a long, long time because it's about what data do you have. And the data that we have is based on the standards that we have. It's all a very complex system. So the only way you're going to change accountability in the very long run, and this is a very long run, is to really rethink what it is we're expecting students to be able to know and do when they leave college, or leave high school, sorry. So at the end of the day, I mean, our state assessment system, which I support, it was a critical part of No Child Left Behind and bringing transparency for all kids. At the end of the day, it gives us a really good picture of what math and reading at certain grade levels, critical, important, for me, must-haves. And we can use it to measure growth and everything, but there's other things that we want our students to be able to know and do when they leave high school. And that's the conversation that we're going to have as states.
Absolutely.
And know that it's going to be, it's cost. The other problem is it's money. Testing costs money. So it's a very political conversation. And also depends on how high the stakes a state makes it for their schools.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, Carla, when I look at this, right, accountability has to be redefined so that we do see the outcomes, or the inputs would have this high level of quality and efficacy to be able to address students with disabilities and also the multiple student groups that we are seeing as the new demographic in education. But it just resonates with me, right? I keep on referencing back to what you said, the invisible disabilities of the 85%. And I think a lot of people across the country really have, and when we look at students with disabilities, the 15%, the concentration with the 85%, I think that historically, or we continue to look at them or not pay attention, I should say, where there should be focus and vitality around the 85%, so that cumulative 100 of all is there. But you're right, rethinking what high school looked like in that new generation of accountability. Data, 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 data.
Transparency, transparency, transparency.
Absolutely. Now, here's the thing, and Carlo, let's unwrap that, right? What does transparency and accountability look like in this reciprocal manner? Because again, transparency, we could spend another hour on what that looked like in context, but 30 seconds, if you could just elaborate on it for my listeners.
I think what parents saw was a lack of transparency. Like when someone's school shut down, we didn't know what to do.
Right.
You have schools that are using more personalized competency-based learning systems. They have systems in place that you know exactly what a student is working on any given day. That and some schools are still trying to do that. You know, everybody started using Google Class. Everything happened overnight because there was, oh my gosh, we don't know where the kids are. That is one of the things I think parents saw and did not like. And we want to know, what are they working on? What are they learning? What are the things that we can be working on at home? That's the kind of transparency I'm thinking about. And at the state level, lots of more data disaggregation, I think, is needed. Also, if you don't mind, I want to put a disclaimer out there. I know some of the terms like invisible may be uncomfortable to some of the disability advocates out there. And for them, I apologize, but I want to say this. I have spent the past year really trying to figure out how to communicate the issues in special education to people who don't know anything. So I want to put that disclaimer. That's why I use some of the terms that I use, is to try to unwrap these really complicated terms for people who are not immersed in this world every day. And also, it's also been interesting to me to realize that I think a lot of people shy away from the issue for a couple reasons. One is it's very legally contentious. We all know that. And two, because they're afraid of saying the wrong thing and offending someone. So that's why I'm even offering a disclaimer. And I often joke, they're also scared of big mama bears like me that can cry at the drop of a hat. And it's true. It's very true. So, I made a note. One thing I wanted to touch back on, the Gen Z and the Alpha thing. Yeah. That really stands out to me because that's such an important thing, the important work that Getting Smart does. When you think of, and yeah, I have that son, 19. When I think of him, and actually my daughter too, one of the two things I think of is that they're used to getting anything they want on demand. And they're used to being able to curate it themselves, to personalize it themselves. Then we ask them to go back to school and experience the complete opposite.
Absolutely.
So those are the two things I think of, the three things I think of that we should be learning about is better transparency, students being able to kind of own their own learning, curate their experiences, and being able to access it more on demand.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the new economic demand. Right. I mean, if you think about it, and that's what our kids experience. My son, he's a Gen Ace, you know, he's part of Generation Alpha. He's 8. I remember I put a rotary phone in front of him. He didn't even know. So, and I think about it is that he can highly manipulate an iPad or an iPhone in ways that I don't know how to, but we're still educating our students or my son, you know, still, and I'm thinking about this, not at, you know, when I'm thinking about holistically, we're still educating kids in this rotary phone industrial model. And I mean, we see it, right? This disjunction or this misalignment of this on-demand that our students engage in, and, you know, going back to more monolithic, didactostatic approaches that we need to change. Last question, Carla. Last question. I don't know how, I don't know. I mean, you're a disruptor, right? I like to say a serial disruptor. So take this question as it is. I'm not going to essentially limit you, Carla, because again, you're right. A lot of people do not know, including myself, the really deep, complex intricacies with this whole phenomenon as it speaks to students with disabilities. And I really, really appreciate you bringing your deep, deep understanding and knowledge around this area. But what three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regards to inclusive education? I left it very abstract on purpose so that you can get down to that disaggregated level of specificity to identify the three words with inclusive education. What three words would you define the paradigm of education for students with disabilities?
I'm thinking. Well, I'm going to say the first one will probably surprise, well, not you, but it may surprise others. Research. We have decades of research that shows that students who are in classrooms with typical peers achieve better. They achieve higher. They do better. There is no research to show that students will do better in a self-contained environment with students like them. But that's kind of what people think. So I would say research, because we're not designing based on research right now. We're designing on based convenience and other things.
Yeah, yeah.
The next word I throw out, I know can be precarious for some, loved by others, it's equity, making sure that a true equity lens includes all kids. The third one, it's not really a word, it's more of a phrase, but I'm just, you know, I'm always real with you.
Yeah.
For me, it's about, I think of image bearer. I believe that all kids bear the image of our Lord. And they're all children. And so,
You could add on to that, please, because I drop Bible verses at least once or twice every other episode. Go right ahead, sister.
So I apologize, it's not one word, but that's, to me, that is the core of what I believe and what I think and what I do. It's developing the God-given potential of every child because they all bear the image of their Creator. So.
Listen, Carla, everybody knows, right? My mother is a deaconess of a church. Every day she's giving me a new Bible scripture or something, right? And you are right. Every student should be able to reach their potential within the image of God, right? And that's just me. I mean, it's just how I believe. That's how I was raised, right? Raised on the context of the word. And that's why we're here today, and while we're both living and able to do God's work, I like to say, to create equitable environments, like you said, with an equity lens. But now when I go back, I want to go back and expand on this into my audience, which I hope is that now we should start grounding our work with research, right? Research and data. You know, those are two meta themes that I took from this podcast. I mean, obviously, please, in an asynchronous manner, just like on demand, my listeners, please go back. And there's a lot of nuggets that Carla had identified. But again, that theme of research and data to be able to not only just drive policy development and language, but also implementation. So Carla Phillips, Privacus. Yes, right.
Close.
All right, I ain't even going to say no more. I'm just going to say Carla. I always just say Carla. So, hey, listen, sister, it has been an absolute pleasure for you to be on Voices for Excellence. Now, I mean, I know this is going to be an up and down time for you because your son is about to make his announcement and his choice. And I'm always going to say this. I'm going to be praying for you, sis. And I know God is going to lead him to the right decision where he's going to wind up.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity, and thank you for all that you do.
Absolutely.
Look forward to seeing you soon.
Carla, we are going to see each other soon, but right before we get off, for my listeners, right, my advocates, policy wonks, politicians that want to be able to get in contact with you with regards to, you know, really strengthening the implementation of laws when it pertains to students with disabilities, or even taking a look at their own current policy language and structure and how to be able to improve that or accelerate specific inputs and throughputs, how would they be able to get in contact with you?
My website is thinkinclusion.org. My Twitter handle is think_inclusion. And my email is Carla with a K at thinkinclusion.org.
Carla, thank you so much, sister. I look forward to seeing you soon. On that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.